Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. It is Monday, and that means my dad will call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We are going to talk about advertising and slogans and the way that cereal boxes are designed in that regard. That's all coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And it is Monday, which means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me every Monday. Eric will not be joining us this morning. He is in Utah at the Sundance Film Festival. He'll be checking in with us tomorrow, Tuesday morning. He'll check in, and we'll get a report from Sundance, exclusive reviews of movies that he's seeing in Sundance that we'll get a chance to see in the coming weeks or months ahead. So he always covers the film festivals for us, so he's not on this morning. So Jim Laskowski, our good friend from the Now Playing Network and Voices and Visions podcast, is going to sit in. And we thank Jim for sitting in, our good friend Jim Laskowski. So, but we've got last week we did our best movies of the year special show. So we didn't review any of the new films that came out last week. So we are going to review the movies that came out last week, this week, and the new ones that came out this week. And that's all coming up. Also, I want to bounce off the results of the SAG Awards off of these guys, and then later on in the show, I will also give you my thoughts on the SAGs, and we'll take some phone calls on that. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's make it official. And let's welcome the guys to the show. Here's Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
And here's Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hello, Nick. It's a pleasure to be back and pinch hit for Eric today.
Yeah, well, thanks for sitting in for us. We appreciate it. And we're going to get to the new movies, movies from last week. And I'll talk about the box office a little bit later on and a little bit about the SAG Awards as well. Jim, tell everybody about your NowPlayingNetwork.net.
Sure. It was created around the time I decided to depart as full-time host of Directors Club, simply just I wanted to focus my energy elsewhere in hopes of creating a community of friends and listeners and fans that just simply love great conversations and great podcasts, of course, about pop culture. It's kind of a collective at this point of really great shows with great hosts devoted mainly to movies and music right now. And there are a lot of great shows, a lot of great content. The Pure Cinema podcast is a highlight with Elric Kane and Brian Sauer, as well as the newly revised version, well, actually it's been about a year, of Directors Club featuring new hosts Brad and Al, Vinyl Emergency with Jim Hankey, supporting characters with Bill Ackerman, Movie Madness, of course, hosted by Eric Childress, Fresh Perspective with Rebecca and Jeff, my show, Voices and Visions, and potentially more in the future. So if you want great shows and podcasts about movies and music, all you have to do is go to NowPlayingNetwork.net.
There you go. All right. And again, thanks for sitting in for us. Now, last week, Eric and Colin and myself unveiled our top 20 best films of the year. And Jim, since you're a frequent contributor to the show, and I know that you put together your list, why don't you give us your top 20, starting at 20 and going to 1, your best films of 2017. We can start that way.
Certainly. There's definitely some titles that will be repeated that you guys brought up that I was very happy to hear. A couple maybe not, but here we go. Number 20 for me was Good Time. Number 19 was Blade Runner 2049. Number 18 was Mother. Number 17 was Baby Driver. Number 16 was A Ghost Story. Number 15 was The Meyerowitz Stories. Number 14 was Colossal. Number 13 is Call Me By Your Name. Number 12 is Lady Bird. Number 11 is Lucky. Number 10 is a very interesting documentary called Rat Film. Number 9 is The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Number 8 is a film called Staying Vertical, which I wish more people knew about and would see. Number 7 is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Number 6 is A Quiet Passion. Number 5, The Florida Project. Number 4, Loveless. Number 3, Columbus. Number 2, Personal Shopper. And number 1 for me is Phantom Thread.
Okay. All right. Good list. Yeah, you had some titles in there that weren't on either or any of our lists. So.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, Rad Film is, I sort of came across it unexpectedly. I think it was Michael Phillips of the Tribune had it on his list, and I simply just caught up with it and found it just to be this really interesting documentary about the rat infestations that go on in cities, but this one particularly being Baltimore. And so it had, like, it had a little bit of the Wire quality to it, only, of course, this is nonfiction, because it tackles a lot of ground and a lot of interesting territory about gentrification and systematic racism, a lot of interesting things. So I think people should check out Rat Film.
Okay, there you go. All right, well, did you guys, Colin, did you watch the SAG Awards?
I did not, unfortunately, but no, I did not.
Sorry. Okay, Jim, did you watch them?
No, I did not, actually.
Oh, okay.
I'm excited to hear the winners.
I watched it, and so let's go through the winners and see if you guys agree. For in the motion picture category, for outstanding performance by an actor in a leading role, I don't think anybody's surprised that Gary Oldman won. You know, he seemed surprised, which I was, you know, surprised. That he seemed surprised. Outstanding performance by an actress in a leading role went to Frances McDormand. Deservedly so. But man, that's a good category, though. I mean, actually all of the acting this year, all of the acting per, you know, categories are really strong. So Frances McDormand, of course, she came up and she's just a handful, that woman. I love her. Outstanding performance by a male in a supporting role went to Sam Rockwell. For Three Billboards, I kept thinking that Willem Dafoe was going to lock this category up, but now the more I'm thinking and the more I'm seeing, you know, especially because he got the SAG Award, I think Sam Rockwell, this could be his year.
Yeah, I know. It's a genuine surprise. I mean, given a little bit of the backlash that has occurred, particularly with his character, and, you know, that's been talked about quite a bit. But I also thought Willem Dafoe, that this was going to be his year. So it's,
yeah, I mean, it yeah, still could right, be. It surprise. Still could be. Colin, what are you thinking?
Yeah, the same thing, because the, like Jim said, the backlash, or, you know, pretty much stems from his character.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's kind of disappointed that, oh my God, there's an arc, and it's not, you know, he's not beaten to a pulp by the end of the film.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
It's absurd for people.
Yeah,
I mean,
it really is.
I mean, you can't make a movie about flawed people.
Right. That's, yeah. Exactly. Like, everybody wants the movie to be the end all be all of social commentary and social justice, but it's like, no, that's not the movie's responsibility.
No.
To be that.
No. And it's one. Right. And it's absolutely one of the best movies of the year, and absolutely one of the best acted films of the year. No, there's no question about it. Outstanding performance by a female in a supporting role, Allison Janney for I, Tonya. And I gotta say, you know. Like this other cat, like the other supporting category, I thought it was going to be Laurie Metcalf. You know,
yeah.
I thought she had a lock on it, and it looks like it's going to be Allison Janney's year.
The war of the domineering mothers.
Yeah, 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 yeah. You could also throw Holly Hunter in there.
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah. So I mean, look, Allison Janney's phenomenal in I, Tonya. She's great, and you know, it's a really juicy performance, and she, you know, obviously, she's going to get some accolades for it. Outstanding performance from a cast, and that went to Three Billboards, and then the stunt ensemble in a motion picture went to Wonder Woman. So there you go. And then I'll talk about the television side of that a little bit later. But it's brewing up to be, you know, I mean, again, this could be anybody's game. As we were talking about before, Colin, you know, that it's always fun when we have a season, an award season where it could go either way. There's no real locks here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more fun that way. It's I mean, sometimes, you know, the obvious choice is also the right choice, as it was, you know, many years ago with Return of the King. We all knew that was going to sweep, and it deserved to sweep. But
yeah,
this year it's wide open, and it could go anywhere. And it seems to be, more of a recurring thing now, where they, because the Academy has gotten a lot better at spreading the wealth in terms of what wins. You know, we don't really have that many, you know, sweeps anymore. So that just make, and now we have new Academy members that are more diverse, you know, and so the game has changed completely, which is just more fun and exciting now.
Yeah. Oscar nominations, by the way, tomorrow morning, and yep. I'll be up early. Well, I'll be awake because I will have already been up all night, and I will be watching them. And you know, I'm gonna try and predict the nominations tomorrow on the show tomorrow morning before they announce them. I really think that the only absolute lock in terms of performance is Gary Oldman. I mean, I think that's that. Mm-hmm. You may as well bet the house that he's gonna win.
So, yeah, for sure.
Well, let's see. Let's start with, Jim, why don't you tell us about the commuter? This is from last week.
Yeah, happy to. So Liam Neeson is back with the same director that brought us films like Nonstop and Taken, and they team up for the fourth time in this thriller set on a Metro North train heading out of New York City. Neeson here plays a life insurance salesman named Macaulay, and he finds himself, once again, kind of in a interesting and tightly confined space, confronting bad guys who want to, you know, simply want to use him for his certain set of skills to accomplish an evil deed. He meets an assertive woman on the train, played by Vera Farmiga, and she assigns him to find a certain person on the train that is carrying a mysterious bag. And if he manages to accomplish this task, he will go home with $100,000, no questions asked, and he's just recently lost his job, of course, and, of course, he also used to be a cop, so it may seem like he's well-equipped to take this task on, but then many twists and turns occur that make the circumstances a bit more challenging as time goes on. Also on board, no pun intended, is his friend and fellow officer, Patrick Wilson, who may or may not help out in this interesting predicament. So, clearly, this director loves Hitchcock, as well he should. He manages to sort of, like, copycat some aspects of Strangers on a Train, of course, and maybe a little bit of The Lady Vanishes here. And I think the collaborations between him and Neeson are mixed at best. Like, sometimes they're solid escapist entertainment, and you have a good time, you leave your brain at the door, and, you know, you probably forget about it as soon as the closing credits roll, but you were still, you know, entertained. And, you know, other times you do have something pretty well done, like Taken, which went beyond expectations to become kind of a classic and kickstarted Neeson's career as an action star. The Commuter is definitely not in the same league as Taken, and it really cannot sustain itself through kind of an intriguing setup, even if it's very implausible as it goes on and on. And you kind of expect that with these types of movies anyway. But at the same time, I was never bored. I was somewhat curious as to how things were going to play out, and I was trying to remain optimistic despite many eye-rolling moments. So you have to suspend disbelief in a major, major way here. But this turned out to be just barely passable entertainment. It's more in the middle for me. I happen to be a fan of Hitchcock, and even when directors emulate plots or styles that are similar to his films, but it's not breaking new ground. But much like Nonstop, I simply just kind of let myself enjoy this piece of escapist entertainment despite its many plot holes. So I'm giving it a very mild recommendation, despite well knowing it's pretty ridiculous. Okay.
All right. It's Jim Leskowski sitting in for Eric Childress, who is in Utah at the Sundance Film Festival. And he'll be joining us tomorrow with an exclusive report from Sundance and exclusive reviews of movies that he's seen out there. But right now, we want to thank Jim for sitting in. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll catch up from movies last week since we didn't review any of the new ones from last week. We'll do catch up on that and then review the new movies. And I'll tell you about the box office as well. That's all coming up right after the news here on 720 WGN. Good morning. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Monday, beginning of the week. That means we want to start off your work week with a laugh, so my dad's going to call in and tell the joke. It's a jokey-jokey time. We're going to talk about advertising and cereal boxes and mascots and all kinds of cool stuff. That's going to be coming up a little bit later on. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page. So like us right now, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. All righty then. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. Yeah. Okay. So Colin and Jim are with me. Jim filling in for Eric, who is in at Sundance Film Festival right now. And we'll get a live report from him tomorrow morning. But we got some older movies to catch up on. And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right. Well, The Commuter. It is absolutely ridiculous. It is a supremely silly movie. But I mean, I agree with you. There are entertaining moments in it. You know, and Neeson is a guy that you can watch do anything. I mean, he just commands the screen. the plot has an interesting setup, but as it goes along, it gets more and more ridiculous. How they end up getting all of the possible suspects into one train car is ridiculous. You know, the outcome at the end, like who ends up being the good guys and the bad guys at the end, you see that coming, like, I mean, you know, within 10 minutes, you can see the big twist. There's supposed to be a big twist at the end of who's really the bad guy. And that's that you can see a mile away. There are a couple of extended fight scenes that are really beautifully shot. There's one in particular that is essentially almost one take. It's really beautifully choreographed and shot, and the camera movements are really good, and it's well edited. You know, so there's a couple of there's an extended fight sequence between him and another guy that I'm talking about specifically. Is a really beautifully shot scene. You know, it's watchable, but it is a supremely silly movie. And you know, you got a guy like Sam Neill with like four lines of dialogue.
Yeah, no, I know. That really bugs me.
And Elizabeth McGovern, who is just, it's so nice to see her back on the screen. She's in the movie for 4 seconds. And yeah. I was hoping for more of Elizabeth McGovern because I really like her and I haven't seen her on screen in a long time. Vera Farmiga shows up for one scene and then phones in the rest. Yeah. And, you know, Patrick Wilson's got a pretty juicy role in it, and it's always fun to watch him. And some of the supporting characters are kind of amusing, you know, how they handle them. You know, the Wall Street guy is pretty funny. The girl who is carrying fake IDs for her boyfriend just kind of cracked me up. So there were some characters that are on board who could or could not be suspects, and that's kind of handled in a funny way. I'm with you, Jim. I think it's, you know, it's fine. You know, you could find, you know, worse ways to kill an hour and 45 minutes. It's just a very silly movie, but you know, you're going to go to this movie and you want it. It's like, it's nonstop on a train instead of a plane is essentially what it is. So, it was,
exactly,
it's fine. So there you go. All right. Colin.
Yeah.
Why don't you, now you and Jim are going to handle this one. Why don't you tell me about Paddington 2?
All right. Well, this is the sequel to the modest hit from a couple of years ago, of course, based on the famous Paddington books. And now Paddington the Bear has settled in with his family, the Browns, and has become a member of the community. Everyone has accepted him, except maybe for the next-door neighbor, played by Peter Capaldi, but that's a minor character here. The new neighbor, though, may be more of a threat. Played by Hugh Grant, he's a has-been actor who is a kind of master of disguise, and he figures into a plot having to do with this pop-up book that Paddington is trying, this one-of-a-kind pop-up book that Paddington is trying to buy for his auntie on her 100th birthday. But the book provides clues that the Hugh Grant character is trying to solve, and things get suspicious when news item after news item has to do with something important being stolen or, you know, a place being burglarized. And eventually a series of mishaps land Paddington the Bear in jail. So this is, you know, the kind of sequel where, you know, everything's been established from the first film. So now we can kind of move on from expository stuff and just get right into the storyline. And also, you know, we're going to break up all the main characters. You know, we're going to break up the Paddington from the family and, you know, introduce new characters into the fold. It's also now the first film was a film that I liked. It was a surprisingly very charming little fantasy film. And you know, it was well made and had the right actors, and you know, it was cute and charming, and inventive. But I think this sequel goes many steps beyond that film. First of all, it has a better villain. Nicole Kidman was the villain in the first film, and was just a little too dark, not very interesting. Hugh Grant is a lot more fun. He, you know, just playing a very pompous, pretentious actor who's now relegated to doing dog commercials, and he still thinks he's, you know, God's gift to Shakespeare. That's more fun. There are, the movie is directed by Paul Kig, who directed the first film. And this guy's got, I mean, he's done mostly TV work and, you know, music video work. And this guy's got a really interesting visual sensibility. It's somewhere between Wes Anderson and Babe Pig in the City, which is pretty, you know, great territory. That's really good company to be in, you know, for a studio project being released in January, you know, and a sequel at that. This movie is just a delight for the eyes. Every single shot has something inventive in it. Every single, you know, piece of art direction, and you know, just the framing of it is just beautiful and exquisite. And there are sequences in this movie where I was just like, wow, this is so beautiful. You know, there's animated sequences in it. There are just these really, really great single tracking shots in the film. So the movie, this is one of those movies that really just could have phoned it in easily, but didn't have to. It went many extra miles to create a movie that is visually stunning, and incredibly inventive. I mean, there, you know, the story, you know, may seem a little conventional. You know, you got your burglars, you got your bumbling villains and everything like that. But it's got, you know, the way it gets from one set piece to another is very inventive. And you know, just every little thing has a payoff somewhere eventually. And you get to see Sally Hawkins diving into water again. So there's that. and yeah, so I mean, the cast is also having a great time with it too. You got Brendan Gleeson is in this one now, and Jim Broadbent and Joanna Lumley has a scene in it that's pretty funny. So it's getting to be like the Harry Potter movies now, where you're not going to be taken seriously as an actor until in the UK, until you land in a Harry Potter or a Paddington movie. So really, I mean, this is a really big surprise. I mean, not surprising because the first one was good, but surprising in just how good the sequel is. And that we, you know, have our first, I think, great movie of the year for 2018. And, you know, it's only a second. It came out, what, second week of January? So I like the first Paddington. I love the second Paddington.
So. All right. Cool. All right. Hang on. And then we'll get Jim's thoughts. Hang on a second. I haven't seen it. So we'll find out. Colin loved it. And we'll find out what Jim thought of it. That's Paddington 2. And we're catching up on a week old movies. And then we'll do this week's movies as well. All right. It's the movie reviews. And we'll get more of them right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Monday morning, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We got a lot more stuff coming up as well. Monday morning means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. We're playing a little catch-up. Last week, we didn't review any of the new releases because we did our year-end special where Eric and Colin and I unveiled our favorite movies of the year. So we're playing a little catch-up on that. And Eric, by the way, who is off this morning, he'll be joining us tomorrow morning live from Utah. He's at the Sundance Film Festival, and we'll get some exclusive reviews of some of the movies that he's seeing there. So he's not on with us this morning. So our good friend Jim Leskowski is kind enough to sit in. Before the break, Colin told us about Paddington 2, and he loved it. Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back. Now, I have not seen it, but Jim, where do you stand on Paddington 2?
I echo everything Colin said. I absolutely love this movie. I can't wait for you to see it, Nick. It's just a delight from beginning to end, and it does improve quite significantly from the first one. I mean, I really liked the first one, but then this one, I just kind of went, oh my gosh, as Colin was saying, like, it's visually inventive, and, you know, like, there's a sequence involving, like, the pop-up book kind of coming to life. I just kind of went, oh my goodness. I was really taken with how this film really stepped things up visually on a lot of occasions, and it felt kind of appropriate to see the trailer for Isle of Dogs before this, because it seems like in that same spirit. I almost like how Wes Anderson's kind of making these live action cartoons essentially. And, you know, here there's a wonderful Chaplin homage at one point. And Brendan Gleeson in particular is having a ball as the like prison chef. And yeah, just in a wonderful ensemble. And, you know, it's just one of those great feel-good movies that I think, you know, the whole family will enjoy. And, you know, if there is a Paddington 3 in the works, I am 100% on board. I mean, this, if you're a fan of the original, you will really like this one as well. And Hugh Grant is a riot. Be sure to stay for the closing credits. And I can't say enough good things about this movie. It's fantastic. I couldn't have had more fun time.
All right. Okay, well, I'll have to see it then. Paddington 2 getting a couple of rave reviews from Colin and from Jim. All right. Jim, why don't you tell us about Phantom Thread? We've already given away how you feel about it, considering you said it was said it was number one on your list. But tell us about Phantom Thread.
So the one and only Paul Thomas Anderson returns to collaborate with his There Will Be Blood Oscar-winning star, Daniel Day-Lewis, giving us one final blessing before he, quote-unquote, retires. We'll see about that. But here he plays Reynolds Woodcock, a sought-after high-end dress designer in 1950s London. He is admired, revered, and also extremely stingy and controlling, particularly of how his day plays out. And a witness to this behavior is his similarly stoic sister, Cyril, played by Leslie Manville here, and she happens to try and keep him at bay and works alongside him as an assistant. And if there's one thing that Reynolds loves besides fashion, it is a hearty breakfast. And one morning at a local diner, he is instantly engaged with and interested in a radiant waitress named Alma, played by newcomer Vicky Krieps, and they begin a courtship of sorts, kind of initially instigated by Reynolds' offbeat attraction and kind of like the desire to make her into something that he can design or, you know, very similarly just like create from pretty much the first time they go out to dinner. He's, you know, saying you should wear your makeup like this, and she seems to be okay with that. But the dynamic that forms between them is really fascinating. Reynolds often has these like spells of depression or illness, and Alma is there by his side as a caretaker. So what essentially unfolds is this really incredible dynamic between three, I would say, because the sister is very involved in this whole scenario, and they're very complex human beings, sort of struggling to piece together feelings that kind of mirror how some relationships are, until maybe late in the film when revelations come to light that I won't go into great detail here. So suffice to say, this is my favorite film of 2017, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that I'm with you, Nick. Paul Thomas Anderson happens to be my favorite filmmaker, and a lot of it has to do with that he keeps you on your toes. Like, I use the terminology of like subverting expectations for a lot of films, particularly in 2017. But Paul Thomas Anderson does that every time in ways that are very unpredictable. And he also happens to implement some of the best cinematography, music, and of course, acting that you are likely ever to see. And for me, it was instant love from beginning to end with this movie, which is rare since his last couple of films. It took me a couple of viewings to really connect with the characters on screen or even just the loose narrative, particularly with Inherent Vice. And I just found this to be a really great marriage between some of the themes of power and control he explored in The Master, mixed with a little bit of the unconventional romance of Punch Drunk Love. And that happens to be one of my top 10 favorite movies. So, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, he just makes incredibly interesting movies. Now, I know a lot of people who don't connect with them, and that's fine. I understand it, too. I understand, like, not being able to get on board with these portraits of sad desperation and grief. But he also infuses them with a lot of passion, a lot of empathy, and just really great, memorable scenes and characters that you will never forget. I will say that when the revelation happens, I put a smile was on my face, and I also found it to be unabashedly romantic. So I think this is another masterpiece from a great artist, and I can't wait to hear what everybody thinks about this movie when they get to see it, because it's fantastic.
All right. Colin.
Yeah, I like this movie. Clearly not as much as you guys do, but I like it. It was in my top 30, okay? So it made the list in some respect. I wouldn't go so far as to say it subverts expectations from Paul Thomas Anderson. This is pretty much what I expect from Paul Thomas Anderson. It's got Daniel Day-Lewis in it, giving a great performance, and it has an outsider character being brought into this world that they don't really know all the rules, so there's some parallels to The Master, which itself had some parallels to Boogie Nights, but this is more of a taking that sort of that kind of story and giving it a romantic angle it subverts expectations for I think what people might expect from the movie who aren't necessarily up on what Paul Thomas Anderson does. People are just going to see the movie because it's nominated for awards, or they like Daniel Day-Lewis, or it looks interesting from the trailer. I think the trailer, in that way it subverts expectations, because this is not the movie that a lot of people are going to expect it to be, especially as it goes along. This is not a movie that is going to go the A to B to C conventional storytelling route. Not like a lot of Anderson's movies, don't. One of the things that I think I just don't quite connect with as much as maybe you guys do is just the overall story itself. I think it's three very strong characters in it, and that I just kind of wish I had felt a little more of the tension, which would make it a little more palpable. I wish there was more done with the idea of the fact that Reynolds sews something, a word or a name or something, into every dress or fabric that he puts on. I kind of wish there was more done with that, because I think that's a really intriguing idea. As far as the relationship between the characters, from scene to scene, it is fascinating to watch. It is fascinating to watch Daniel Day-Lewis just kind of become this child in so many scenes. It's sort of a repugnance, and just becomes a big baby in a way that is just. That is part of the power struggle that is kind of fascinating. I really do like this movie. I definitely think people should see it. If they can, they should see it at the Music Box in 70mm and also buy the soundtrack, because Johnny Greenwood's score is amazing. I definitely recommend it.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll have my review for it. Colin, hang on. Jim, hang on. We'll take a break here, and then when we come back, I will give you my thoughts on Phantom Thread, Paul Thomas Anderson's new movie with Daniel Day-Lewis, and that's coming up right after this. Welcome back. Everybody, how are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 o'clock. We're going to be talking about advertising and slogans and the hypnotic power of cereal boxes in that world. My dad will call in and tell a joke, because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. And speaking of Monday, it is Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Eric Childress, who is in the Sundance Film Festival, is not with us this morning. Jim Laskowski is kind enough to be sitting in. We will hear from Eric tomorrow morning, live from the Sundance Festival, giving us exclusive reviews of some of the stuff that he's seeing. So we're back, and we're playing catch up here before the break. Colin, welcome back, Colin.
Hello.
And Jim, welcome back, Jim.
Hello there.
They gave their thoughts on Phantom Thread, which is the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie with Daniel Day-Lewis. Okay, so I mean, it's no surprise, if you listened to the show last week, it was number two on my best of list, and could have easily been number one. I've seen it three times, and it gets richer every time I see it. I just think it's great. I think it's sumptuous and beautiful and really weird. as it goes along, it just keeps getting weirder, and the relationship itself between these two people, three people really, but the two main characters, goes in directions that are very unusual, and I think some people will find it off-putting, to say the least, as to where it goes. I think Paul Thomas Anderson wants to make his version of Rebecca. We were talking about Hitchcock a little bit earlier. There's a lot of Hitchcock in this movie. It's complex and it's fascinating just to see how these characters interact with one another. And I mean, obviously, Paul Thomas Anderson is a great director of actors. I mean, he gets great performances out of his performers and out of his actors. And again, I mean, obviously Daniel Day-Lewis is one of the greatest actors that's ever lived, and he's phenomenal in this movie and a very complex character. Vicky Krebs is where did that come from? She's unbelievable. Leslie Manville, who is just a tremendous actress in every regard, is great in it as well. The dynamic between the two of them, between brother and sister, Daniel Day-Lewis and Leslie Manville, is fascinating and fun. And the power struggle that happens between these characters, it becomes really strange and surprising. And the revelation, you know, late in the film is pretty astonishing and, you know, adds such a weird level to what's going on between these characters. There is a sequence where that I find genuinely unnerving, and it involves the Daniel Day-Lewis character is loved his mother and respects his mother. In fact, has his mother's name sewn into his jacket, so he always, you know, a piece of her cloth always next to his heart. And he's obsessed with his mother, and I think that has a lot to do with how he handles this. The character that Vicky Krebs plays, I personally think he sees a lot of his mother in her. There is a really unnerving scene where he's very sick and, like, the ghost of his mother, is in the room. It's really amazing. There's also all these really amazing things where, like, in, for instance, Leslie Manville, I don't know if you guys noticed this, Leslie Manville is kind of obsessed with closing doors in this movie. She closes the doors and closes this and closes the shades. And if you notice, as the movie goes on and the power struggle continues and the weirdness starts to happen, Vicky Krebs' character keeps the doors open. Like, she opens doors and leaves them open. And it's just these little power things that I've seen the movie three times now, but you notice all that kind of stuff and it makes it richer the character Daniel Day-Lewis plays wants it absolutely silent at breakfast in the morning. And there's a scene in the movie where she's like spreading butter on the bread and crunching her teeth and like biting on the fork. And they just keep cutting back to Daniel Day-Lewis sitting at the table. And it's one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie. He doesn't say anything, but like, but it's just such this great, and again, really subtle sort of digs at what this power struggle between these characters, beautifully mounted, exquisitely shot. The costume design is amazing. I was interested in dress design of something I don't care about. The first scene where he dresses her is one of the sexiest and most romantic scenes in the film year, as far as I'm concerned. And just what happens in this movie is just fascinating. It's beautiful and weird, and it's Paul Thomas Anderson. So I loved it. And by the way, Colin, you're right. Johnny Greenwood's score is unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and I also noticed when you were talking about the buttering of the bread scene, the way that Anderson just cranks up the sound on that is also really funny.
Well, there's a lot of food consumption in this movie, a lot, and it's obviously there's a reason for that, you know. But like, that's the craziest breakfast anybody's ever ordered at the beginning of the movie, and then you get a nice overhead shot of it. And I was like, because like we were talking about, you know, on our subcategories, movies that made you the hungriest. This by far was the movie that made me the hungriest. I wanted a mushroom omelet. I wanted asparagus. I wanted that giant breakfast. Just crazy. So I loved it. Phantom Thread. I really don't know how the public is going to perceive this movie because I think it's going to be a little off-putting. I recommended it to Kathy O'Malley, and she now wants to kill me. So I don't know what to say, but I loved it. I adored it. I thought it was great. Okay, let's move on to the new stuff. Colin, you saw Forever My Girl?
Yeah. This was actually my first film of 2018. I didn't see Paddington 2 until today.
So. Oh, okay. All right. Well, all right, man. Welcome to 2018. Forever My Girl. Colin, enlighten us.
Okay. Well, this stars Alex Rowe as a country singer who, at the beginning of the film, he leaves his fiancée at the altar on the day of their wedding and isn't heard from again in this town for 8 years. So at the beginning of the movie, he's about to marry his sweetheart, played by Jessica Roth, and he doesn't show up. He eventually becomes a world-famous country singer, and then 8 years later, a friend of his dies, and that brings him back home, where he basically hides away from the world after canceling the last show on his tour. So he stays with his dad, played by John Benjamin Hickey, and eventually reunites with Jessica Roth, who now has an 8-year-old daughter, and of course it's his. So now he has to earn back the goodwill of his ex-fiance, his dad, and now he has to face the notion of being a dad to the daughter he never knew he had. So that sounds like, well, you said earlier in the show that the commuter is, you know, that there are worse ways to spend an hour and 45 minutes. This is one of those ways. This is a far worse. And I didn't even see, and I shouldn't, you know, I didn't see the commuter. Pretty sure this is worse. Just by virtue of the fact that in the center of the film's protagonist is this, you know, black hole of charisma named Alex Rowe. And there, you know, basically plays this kind of lunkhead of a character that the audience has no chance of ever really connecting with. The storyline I described sounds like there's a lot of, you know, conflict and, just a lot of drama, but every scene, every problem that comes up is basically solved in the next scene. Everything is very agreeable in this movie. You know, everybody's just kind of eventually just okay with him being back and him just trying to be a dad and trying to be this person that, you know, nobody thinks he can be. But it's okay. Everything's fine. And that's basically what it feels like for a good hour and 45 minutes. There's a really muddled drama about how he is, you know, speaking of mother problems, you know, what caused him to run away from the altar is because, you know, of his mom dying and how that had this severe effect on him. And it doesn't track at all. It is really poorly written. And so this is what people are talking about when they use the term chick flick and how they hate chick flicks. I hate the term chick flick, and I also hate this flick. So this is a really stupid, this is as dumb as the trailer makes it out to be. It is really poorly written. The cast is, you know, except for the main characters, they're somewhat likable. The little kid didn't bug me as much as I thought she would, but she's pretty kind of annoying. So this should be avoided at all costs.
Okay. I can't believe you saw it.
My first bullet of the year.
Okay, hang on, Colin, all right?
Okay.
Jim, hang on, all right? We got more movies to review. More movies to review coming up right here on WGN. And by the way, that was called Forever My Girl, and he hated it. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio, seventh floor of the Trip Tower. And we're here till 5. We are reviewing the new movies, and I'll talk about the box office as well. And we'll talk a little bit about the SAG Awards. If you watched the SAG Awards last night, we'll talk about that. Plus, we're going to talk about slogans and advertising and all kinds of other fun stuff. And my dad will tell a joke. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Let's get back to the movie reviews. Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Jim, tell us about Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story.
Yeah, happy to.
I'm sorry, but I'm sorry. Hedley, every time I hear him, I think of Blazing Saddles every single time. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. Yeah, this will be quick because the title says it all. I mean, it is really just a wonderful sort of bio documentary. It's currently playing at the Music Box, and you know, the actress that most are familiar with, and not just for her acting talents, but her ravishing beauty, of course. But little did I know is that she was also an inventor who's concepts were the basis of cell phone and Bluetooth technology, and it's really a fascinating just portrayal of her inventiveness. And the glamour icon here is just, you know, she's was also, I didn't learn about this until recently too, is just she was the inspiration for Snow White and Catwoman. And, you know, what unfolds is not just your typical sort of birth to death bio documentary, but it's a, you know, kind of a portrait of what we saw in The Imitation Game. It's a story about someone whose intelligence was, you know, kind of shadowed and obscured until history caught up. And here it weaves interviews and clips with never before heard audio tapes of Hedy speaking on the record of her incredible life. It does cover the scandalous nude scene that she did in very early in 1933 to her, you know, just her groundbreaking sort of glittering Hollywood life. But we also learn a lot about her completely uncredited inventions, where then she became a recluse and kind of almost forgotten. So there's a little bit of a downward spiral that's kind of focused on late in the film that you kind of anticipate to some degree. But this is mainly focused on her incredible achievements and accomplishments that are well worth knowing about. And not just if you're an old school cinephile interested in old Hollywood, this is really an inspirational story for women in general. And it serves as kind of a profile for how women are undermined despite their gifts and many strengths and talents. I wouldn't put this on par with something like Jane from last year, but it's well worth your time. It's absolutely worth seeing to learn about an interesting facet of a life that I knew very little about. So I'm recommending this one for sure.
Okay, and it's at the Music Box if you would like to see it. All right, yeah. Jim, tell us about Small Town Crime. I know this is available on the VOD as well.
Oh, man. So if you're a fan of Elmore Leonard, have I got a film for you. This is anchored by the terrific character actor John Hawkes, most recently seen in a small part in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Here he plays kind of another down-on-his-luck loser of sorts. He's kind of an alcoholic, and he's a disgraced ex-cop who lost his job due to his alcoholism, and he's trying to outrun his past, redeem himself, find a much better job that he could be happy with, but he's unfortunately an addict, and he can't shake that. But his shot at redemption arrives one morning after one of his benders when he discovers the battered body of a young woman in an empty field not too far from where he passed out. And he sort of that sort of sparks an impetus in him. He wants to find the killer and redeem himself in the process. He also receives some interesting backup from the victim's vengeful grandfather, played by Robert Forrester, and a pimp named Mood, played by the great Clifton Collins Jr. So, yeah, I mean, you have an ensemble like that, and sign me up right away. You also have Anthony Anderson and Octavia Spencer. So this is really just one of those solid neo-noir films. And I know I say this a lot. It's nothing we haven't seen before. It's not groundbreaking, and it's definitely apt here. However, just once in a while, like a neo-noir comes out of nowhere, something like Blue Ruin, and it's not only effective, but just really involving and intense. And this is definitely one of the better examples of like a Coen Brothers-esque film, like akin to something like Blood Simple. But the movie I think it kind of resembles happens to be one of my favorites, and that's Night Moves with Gene Hackman. It's not nearly as great, but the cast here saves it. I mean, it makes it well worth seeing. John Hawkes is obviously one of the best character actors working today, and it ends with a brutal, superbly shot shootout that is kind of worth the price of admission alone. But also you have Clifton Collins Jr., Robert Forrester. They both play a vital role in how things play out. So I really like Small Town Crime. It is a genuinely compelling film that might turn out to be like the Blue Ruin of this year. So I highly recommend it.
All right, cool. Small Town Crime. It's available on video on demand as well. By the way, none of us saw Den of Thieves, the 2.5-hour Gerard Butler movie.
That should tell you everything right there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Why didn't we go see that?
All right, we got a couple more movies to talk about. Everybody hang on. Colin, hang on. And Jim, hang on. And we're going to take a break for the news. When we come back, we got two more movies to review, and then I'll talk to you a little bit about the box office as well. All right, that's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studios, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Monday means Monday morning movie reviews, and we're right in the middle of that. So let's bring back the guys. Colin, welcome back, Colin.
Hello.
And welcome back, Jim.
Hello there.
All right. Jim Liskowski is filling in for Eric Childress, who is at Sundance Film Festival. We get a live report from him tomorrow morning. So he's off this morning. We thank Jim for sitting in. Colin, tell us about Mary and the Witch's Flower.
All right. Well, this is an animated film, the latest from Studio Ghibli, the animation studio responsible for most, if not all, the Miyazaki films. This one is about a preteen girl who lives in the country with her family, and one day she follows a couple of strange cats into a forest where she comes upon a mysterious flower and eventually a mysterious broom. Well, it's not hard to tell from the movie's title where this is headed, but the broom eventually comes alive and takes Mary to a faraway land where she learns she has special witch powers and that she's been recruited to go to this witch's academy. Now, I know that sounds like I just described something along the lines of Kiki's Delivery Service meets Harry Potter, but that's not what this is. The flower is a highly valuable object, and there are interested parties who want it for themselves, and so a mystery unravels as to where it came from and how it's being used right now and the magic that that it incorporates. This one is directed by Hiromasa Yonebayashi, who directed Secret World of Arrietty and the Academy Award nominated When Marnie Was There from a couple years ago. This one isn't quite as strong as those two films. I think this one kind of gets into standard Studio Ghibli territory with, you know, some of the just basic story elements. Like I said, you know, the story I described didn't sound terribly original, I know. But the whole Witch's Academy part, that's just one small chunk of the film. That's not really a big thing. But when you're watching it, you're thinking, oh my God, this movie is kind of plagiarizing here. This is very Harry Potter-ish. But luckily it takes a turn and doesn't go down that road. But it, you know, where it does go is kind of what we've seen before, but this is still coming from a studio and a director who knows how to, you know, fill the frame with really lovely and arresting visuals. And, you know, with ideas within the action that are, you know, ideas that we really only see in animation, period. So this is still, you know, story problems aside, this is still a solid effort from a studio that really delivers on, you know, what it always promises, which is a great story for kids. Interesting, visually weird, you know, creatures and characters, you know, that morph and do all kinds of interesting things, and adventure, which this movie definitely has. So I am recommending it. This is a you know, there's not going to be a whole lot of, you know, I mean, there's, we don't get a lot of 2D animated films, and they're kind of falling by the wayside. But thanks to studios like Ghibli and distributors like G-Kids, it's still an art form that is valuable and is still thriving in a, you know, smaller degree. But so definitely I think people should check this out and support it. So.
All right. Mary and the Witch's Flower. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool. All right, Jim, tell us about 12 Strong.
Okay, it's based on Doug Stanton's book Horse Soldiers, and it's about a group of ragtag military soldiers whose story was really never told until that book was published. Almost immediately after the horrendous tragedy and attack of 9/11, the military decided to assemble a team to go after some of those responsible for the attack, mainly being Al-Qaeda. And heading the team is Chris Hemsworth, who plays Captain Mitch Nelson, who is sort of trading in his cozy office desk job to go back into action, alongside the great Michael Shannon as Chief Warrant Officer Hal Spencer. Now, the objective here is to simply overtake a Taliban stronghold city and make sure that they don't have the opportunity to attack further. To do so, they sort of have to overcome some initial distrust between them and a particular general and sort of navigate through this very difficult terrain in which horses are pretty much the practical form of travel. It's an interesting warm story. It's an interesting story, and at the same time, it's a war movie that doesn't really represent all sides of, like, you know, a political conflict, and it's not very fair-minded. It sort of reminded me a little bit of what Peter Berg does when it comes to, you know, action directing. This is, I think, the debut from a guy named Nikolaj Fugleslig, and I think he's Danish, and he started out as a war photojournalist, and you can tell that, and you can certainly get the feel for what it's like to be in battle and experience, you know, a constant barrage. And it's interesting for me too. I saw this at a theater where with the Dolby surround sound, and I don't know if it was just where I was sitting. Every time there was a helicopter, an explosion, or bullets, like, my seat was vibrating like crazy. It was crazy. But yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that, like, I found it to be a little objectionable and questionable in that it kind of asks that we sort of forget about the strategic failures of America's war on terror and just sort of dives right in and has it be essentially like, let's go get them, a revenge rah-rah kind of war film. I mean, it's well shot, it's well coordinated with some of the action sequences, but I felt like it felt a little bit like glorifying it to some degree, and I found that a little hard to justify. And I also just wish the characters were a bit more fleshed out when you have actors like Michael Shannon and Michael Pena. So, I guess I was engaged with it on a scene-to-scene basis, particularly when there were large action set pieces going on. But the whole picture itself didn't sit well with me necessarily. So I'm pretty mixed on 12 Strong. But if you're a fan of war films like Black Hawk Down, I mean, you could do a lot worse. But I also don't fully recommend it.
Yeah, I really like this movie a lot. I thought it was pretty great. And, you know, that the attitude of the film, Jim, we have to kind of understand this movie takes place like 2 weeks, you know, it starts, it takes place
yeah,
like
no, that's, you're
two weeks
right
after,
that.
2 weeks after the attacks, on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and the plane in Pennsylvania. And, everybody was, let's go in and get them. You know what I mean? That was the attitude. Yeah. And that sets up the whole beginning of the movie. Like, these guys are leaving their family and their kids. And I think that's established beautifully in the beginning of the film when you get to see these guys have to say goodbye to their kids. And, you know, they just got back from a tour. And now because of this, they want to go back. They want to go back and they want to get in there and they want to fight. So it's essentially about, like, you know, they have 3 weeks to take care of this Taliban town, and they team up with what I thought was an interesting and a really fascinating relationship with the anti-Taliban guy who is their connection. And I thought that that relationship between Hemsworth and him was really well done. The action sequences and the war scenes are tremendous in this movie. Like, they're beautifully shot and they're scary and they're exciting. I thought the camaraderie between the guys was really great. And I, you know, like, two great supporting performances in the leader positions, William Fichtner and Rob Riggle, by the way, Rob Riggle playing his actual old boss. That's true. And so, I thought all that was really good. And the byplay between the soldiers seemed real. And, you know, the need for them to be there and to fight this fight, it seemed palpable to me. And on the simplest of levels, it's just a really exciting movie, and it's really well made. I don't even know if this director is a brand new guy, but I think he handles the battle sequences beautifully. I was rooting for these guys. I cared about them. And I think this was a story that I didn't know. It was a story nobody knew because their mission was classified and nobody knew about it. And at the end of the movie, they show, you know, the actual picture of these 12 guys, who had, you know, and again, the horseback riding scenes in the movie, first of all, some of them are really funny. Like, Michael Pena trying to ride the horse is really funny. But, you know, like, the fact that they had to do that, none of them were ever on horseback. One guy said, yeah, Cabo one time when I was drunk. You know, that's the only experience that they had riding horses. And, you know, just that idea of going in and that the final battle scene where they have to power through, on horseback, where, you know, there's tanks and there's guns and there's, rockets. And these guys have, like, guns and horses, and that's it. And it's an insane, the final battle sequence is pretty insane and really intense. And then at the end, when you see the real guys and, you know, they were heroes. What they did was, you know, it was one of the biggest Taliban losses of all time, you know, and, these guys didn't get a parade. They didn't get any recognition, nothing. And then finally this book comes out, and now the movie comes out. And I think, I really do think it does a nice job showing who these guys were and what they did at that specific time. And how important this battle was. And I think that they deserve the recognition that this movie gives them. So I actually really, I was surprised at how much I liked it. I was really pleasantly surprised at how much I thought I really liked it. And again, the cast, Hemsworth is really good in it. Obviously Michael Shannon goes without saying. Michael Pena and all of the guys who play the soldiers, I think are all really good, solid performances, nice characters. And I think the camaraderie was really strong. And again, beautifully made and exciting. And yeah, Jim, the sound and the sound design and everything. I didn't see it in one of those Dolby theaters. I saw it in a regular theater, but it was still.
Yeah, I thought my head was going to explode.
No, those Dolby theaters are crazy, man.
Sure.
I mean, I've seen many movies in those Dolby theaters, and if I have a chance, if I have a choice to, you know, like if it's a big action, like I saw the last one. I think the last one that we saw in the Dolby theater was Jedi, was Last Jedi, and it was fantastic to see in those theaters. Colin, you've been in those theaters, right?
Yeah, I saw Jedi. They screened, the press screening was at that theater for Last Jedi and also for Spider-Man Homecoming. And yeah, it's a fantastic experience.
It really is. It really is. And if you have the option to go to the Dolby theaters at AMC, do it. Especially if it's a big action movie. It really is. It's really a lot of fun. All right. Well, next week, all we have is one of the Maze Runner movies.
Yeah, 2 hours and 20 minutes of Maze Runner.
Oh, you're kidding. 2 hours and 20 minutes?
Yep. Oh, Lord.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, Jim, listen.
I've never seen any of those movies.
Yeah, neither have I. Neither have I. So it might be a short might have a short segment next week.
All right.
Okay. Jim, thank you so much for filling in, man.
Oh, happy to. Anytime, man.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Colin, we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right. There you go. All right. We're going to take a break. We got weather. We got traffic. And when I come back, I'll give you the box office, and we'll jump into the SAG Awards as well. It's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Let's get the weather and the traffic right away. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Normally, we talk about the box office with Eric Childress. Eric is, as we've mentioned, in Sundance right now, Sundance Film Festival, and he'll be joining us for a live exclusive Sundance report tomorrow morning. So I'm just going to give you the box office numbers to talk a little bit about what made money and what didn't make money over the weekend. We always talk about the box office here on Monday morning. So it's Nick DiGilio at 720 WGN. Here we go. Let's see. Number one at the box office again is Jumanji. Welcome to the Jungle with a very solid $20 million weekend and bringing its total up to over $316 million. And that's just in America. This thing is a pretty big monster success and continues to just dominate at the box office. So number two is 12 Strong with $16.5 million. Actually, really solid, very, very good numbers for this movie. There weren't that many people there when we went to go see it over the weekend, but 16.5, I think that performed better than they thought it would. And then number three is Den of Thieves with $15.3 million. Another pretty solid opening. So two, movies that nobody really thought were gonna really kill at the box office did very well. 16.5 for 12 Strong, the war movie, and then Den of Thieves, the heist movie with Gerard Butler, 15.3, very solid numbers all the way across. Really for early January and all the competition that's out there now, because this is one of those times of year when people are catching up on, the awards movies. And, we're coming up. The Oscar nominations will be announced tomorrow morning. And this is when people will start, once the Oscar nominations come out, this is when people will really try to catch up on the movies that they missed for award season. And I know a lot of completists out there who like to see every movie that's nominated. And again, we never know how many Best Picture nominations there are going to be, because it varies now. It used to be 5 years ago, and then they changed that. And it could be up to 10, 7 or 8 or 9, something like that. So you never really know how many, but a lot of people want to see them. But for two big, sort of action movies to open up this strongly with all the other competition, that was really, really solid numbers for 12 Strong and for Den of Thieves. Number four is Steven Spielberg's The Post, which made $12.1 million, bringing its total up to $45 million. Which is really solid and very good, and it's also a really good movie. If you've not seen The Post, you should. It's really, really good. Number five is The Greatest Showman, which is hanging in there. $11 million, so it did pretty solid business, and $113.4 million is the total it's made so far. So, it's made its money back, and that was a pretty solid showing for it's been out since Christmas, so that's not bad. $11 million, bringing its total up to over $113 million. Number six is Paddington 2, which is in its second week and made $8.2 million, $25 million in the 2 weeks it's been out. And judging by the reviews that you just heard Jim and Colin give, you should probably get out there and see it and support this movie. Surprisingly, two massive raves for Paddington 2. I just thought this movie was just sequel, whatever. And then to hear, Colin and Jim rave about it the way they did. And it's doing okay at the box office. Not great, but you know, if you want to take your kids to it, get them out there soon. $8.2 million. Number seven, The Commuter. $6.6 million. In 2 weeks, it's made $25 million. $25.7 million. Not great numbers at all. So I think people expected it to make a little bit more money, because it's Liam Neeson. But I think the other thing is that I think some people are getting tired of the kind of same old Liam Neeson movies that we're getting. Like, this is essentially, The Commuter is like it's nonstop, except on a plane, it's on a train. But it's essentially the same kind of thing. And I think people are getting a little bit tired of Liam Neeson going through the motions in these sort of quickie action movies. Number eight, Star Wars, The Last Jedi, $6.5 million, bringing its total up to $604 million. And that's just in America. So obviously it's a massive success. Although it's not performing as well as The Force Awakens did, And the backlash against this one is really kind of amazing and shocking. The way that so many people have just disliked this movie, and which I'm surprised. I mean, I'm not a big Star Wars fan, and I actually really, really. Dan, have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't had a chance to.
Okay.
China already pulled it from their theaters.
They did?
It made $29 million over the course of the first weekend, and they just yanked it because nobody was going.
Nobody was going. It underperformed. Wow. Yeah, the backlash is crazy, though. I mean, I'd be interested to see what you think. Are you a Star Wars fan, Dan?
I appreciate them for what they are, but you know, and I enjoy them, but I don't, you know, follow the thing. I'm interested now to see it because all the people that I respect like it for what it's doing to the franchise.
Yeah.
And like, all right, guys, you know, that stuff you kind of love, like, we need to move past that and move into this new era.
That's pretty much what that's why so many people are upset about it. Number nine, Insidious, The Last Key, $5.9 million, bringing its total up to $58 million, which is, you know, solid numbers for a PG-13 horror movie. You know, kind of exactly what you expect. It'll probably, you know, peak out at about $75 million. And then number 10 is Forever My Girl. I still can't believe that Colin went to see it. It made a paltry $4.7 million in its first weekend, Forever My Girl. I saw the trailer for it, and I was like, no. Number 11 is Proud Mary, $3.6 million, not making any money, $16.9 million total. That's the action movie with Taraji P. Henson running around with a gun. And then number 12 is Phantom Thread, which made $3.3 million, bringing its total up to $6.1 million. Not a lot of people are going to see it. It did open wide this weekend. It did open wide this weekend, and that means that the numbers are not very impressive for it. So, which is too bad because it's a great movie. It's a weird movie, though. You know, I mean, it's Paul Thomas Anderson. It's a very strange movie, and like I said earlier, I recommended it to Kathy O'Malley, and now she wants to kill me. So that should tell you something right there. But your big winner again, Jumanji: Welcome to the Jungle, with $20 million and two strong openings. For action movies in January, 12 Strong and Den of Thieves both did very, 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 very impressive business over the weekend. So that's your box office. What we're going to do is take a break for the news, and after the news, we'll talk about the SAG Awards and advertising and so much more. My dad will call in and tell a joke. But yeah, the SAG Awards were given out last night in both television and in movies, and we're going to go through the winners and talk about the show itself. And that's all coming up right after the news, which is 5 seconds away. All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday, and that means my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning and it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Last night, the SAG Awards were presented. The Screen Actors Guild hands out their awards every year, and they hand them out in both movie and television. And it's a fun award show, actually, because it's 2 hours. I don't know how they do it. They don't do any musical numbers or any of that kind of stuff. But it's 2 hours. It went 5 minutes over last night. But, I mean, that's still pretty impressive for you know, an award show to not go 3 hours, you know, not go, you know, a half an hour over. And this was the first year, Dan, did you know this? This was the first year they had a host.
I did hear that.
Yeah, and you know who the host was?
Kristen Bell.
Kristen Bell, and she's just fantastic. I love Kristen Bell, man. She's just the best. She did a great job, you know. She came out, she did a little bit, you know, did kind of a monologue, did some bits with the audience. You know, and showed up like most of these, you know, hosts of these award shows. They're off stage for a really, really long time, and then they come back on and do a couple of bits. She had 4 costume changes, and she was great. She did a really, really good job. She's charming and so funny, and she's really one of the most likable people in Hollywood. And so the show, you know, it went over like 5 minutes, but it was over by, you know, it was over by a little after 9. And they handed out the acting awards. These are strictly for acting. So it's the union, you know, the SAG-AFTRA union. And these are all about just for acting. And the big award is obviously when you get your ensemble, your entire cast wins. That's kind of the best picture award of the night or the best TV show award of the night. So we'll go through the – if you saw it and you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. Some pretty good speeches. You know, the winners that we expected to win pretty much won. There were just a couple of surprises here and there. But for the Motion Picture Awards, the Outstanding Lead Performance by an Actor in a Leading Role was Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour, which I think kind of cements the fact that he's going to get the Oscar. I think that one you can mark down in stone. If you've got an Oscar pool, you might want to bet all your money on Gary Oldman. He's great in the movie too, and it's one of those, you know, physical complete thing, makeup and all that stuff. But he's a great actor too, and he's a guy that has been giving really great performances for many, many years. So I think it's actually kind of about time that he gets an award. Leading actress went to Frances McDormand for Three Billboards, and she's just phenomenal. You know, in any other year, though, Saoirse Ronan, I would give her an award every year just because she's awesome. But, you know, and Sally Hawkins, so good in The Shape of Water. And, Margot Robbie in I, Tonya, also great. And I know that Meryl Streep will probably get nominated for The Post, and that's, like, the best work she's done in years. Strong year for the ladies. Which is awesome. Outstanding performance by a male actor in a supporting role went to my main man, Sam Rockwell, with Three Billboards. I'm very happy about that. They did a bit because Woody Harrelson was also nominated. So they did a bit where they were like, I look at you now and I see competition. And they had to have Frances McDormand get in between them because they had the cast members come up and introduce their clips, you know, for the movies. And they did that bit. Frances McDormand is so hilarious, man. I love Frances McDormand. She's just the best. Performance by a female supporting role, Allison Janney for I, Tonya. You know, as great as she is, I got to say, my vote would go with Laurie Metcalf for Lady Bird. And then Holly Hunter for The Big Sick. I mean, another strong, strong category. And then Outstanding Cast for Theatrical Motion Picture went to Three Billboards, which is a good sign for the Academy Awards. So, and then the Television Awards, the Outstanding Performance by a Male Actor in a Television Movie or Miniseries went to Alexander Skarsgård, Big Little Lies. Big Little Lies has won every conceivable award for everybody involved except Reese Witherspoon. Although she's a producer on this, so she's getting awards anyway. But, like, all the acting accolades the show's getting, Reese Witherspoon doesn't get any of them. But, yeah, Alexander Skarsgård won for Big Little Lies. It was a weird speech, too, because he basically, you know, because De Niro was nominated. And by the way, every time they cut to De Niro, he looked so either pissed or bored. I couldn't tell, you know, he cut to De Niro and he's like, even when he was like, you know, like people getting standing ovations, like they gave the Lifetime Achievement Award to Morgan Freeman. And he wore a baseball hat. I don't know why. And Rita Moreno gave him the award, presented the award to him because they used to work together on this a great show that I watched growing up in the 70s called The Electric Company. They were both on that show. And when she got the Lifetime Achievement Award a couple of years ago, Morgan Freeman presented it to her, so they did the switcheroo. And then he comes up and he's got a baseball hat on. I'm like, what? But anyway, like, you know, when he gets up there and everybody's giving him a standing ovation, they cut to like De Niro and he's like, whatever. But anyway, Skarsgård mentioned, he said, who's the greatest actor on the planet? Is it Robert De Niro or is it the tall guy from True Blood? And then he's like, I think the union has answered that question. And I was like, wait a minute, what are you saying, dude? No, he was stunned. He was surprised. So, outstanding performance by a female actor, television or miniseries, of course, went to Nicole Kidman for Big Little Lies. They don't have this. They didn't do supporting in those categories, which is why Laura Dern didn't win that time, because Laura Dern is winning all of them for Big Little Lies. Outstanding performance by a male actor in a drama series went to Sterling K. Brown for This Is Us. He gave a great speech, too. He's a very cool dude. Outstanding performance by a female actor in a drama series. This was a surprise for me because Elizabeth Moss didn't win. And I was like, huh? Elizabeth Moss for Handmaid's Tale did not win. And I just was beside. Claire Foy won for The Crown. She's great. She's a terrific actress, and she's good. But come on, man. You don't deny my future ex-wife, Elizabeth Moss. You don't do that. Outstanding performance by a male actor in a comedy series went to William H. Macy for Shameless. He wins that, like, every year. Outstanding performance by a female actor in a comedy series. You want to talk about somebody who wins it every year. Julia Louis-Dreyfus for Veep broke the record for winning the most SAG awards. And she wasn't there. She's, I don't know if people know this or not, but she's battling breast cancer. And they've delayed the filming of the new season of Veep until she recovers. And but she sent out a really funny tweet saying, hey, I wish I was there. You know, you guys look like you're having fun at the table. How was the chicken? Which I thought was pretty funny. Outstanding performance by an ensemble in a drama series went to This Is Us. Last year it went to Stranger Things. And if you remember David Harbour's incredible speech, people were hoping that they'd win again and Harbour could get up there and make that speech and have Winona Ryder look at all weird, make weird faces and see pizzas. But no, This Is Us won. And, it was a great speech. Performance by an ensemble in a comedy series went to Veep. So it was a good show. Kristen Bell did a good job. A lot of the when you're trying to figure out as you're leading up to the Oscars how to handicap these things, it starts to get clearer as we get closer. And these, you know, especially how well Three Billboards did, the fact that Sam Rockwell won instead of Willem Dafoe, and it was the SAG Awards, which means their peers are voting for him. It's a good solid sign for Three Billboards and for Sam Rockwell and for obviously for Frances McDormand. So there you go. It was good. It was fun. And Kristen Bell, she's great. She can, you know, remember when Jimmy Kimmel was out when his son had to have surgery and she hosted? Fantastic. She's just the best. So anyway, SAG Awards, they were fun. It was cool. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about some advertising stuff and more.